Music from Sarah Groves. It's 11 minutes after the hour on a Wednesday morning. We're joined by Doug Greenwald, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. And Doug, I guess I could start by saying welcome home. You've been on the road for, a couple weeks now, haven't you?
Oh, 2 weeks and 2 days and 4,200 miles and 10 wonderful speaking opportunities.
Yeah. You know, 2 weeks ago, you spoke to us from Wichita. Last week, it was Dallas. And, and of course, you're based in Columbia, Maryland, which is just outside of Washington. I could see 4,200 miles. Hopefully, it was good weather and an enjoyable trip all the way along.
Actually, a lot of it's pretty boring. You know, the center part of America is pretty flat, but... Boy, when we drove south from Oklahoma City to Dallas on Sunday night, Easter, Good Friday, Sunday, we went through a humdinger of a storm. I was sure we were going to be seeing funnels any second coming at us. But
Well, of course, this time of the year, you don't have a lot of leaves out in the Midwest yet, and the grass is typically not greened up, so it would be kind of a dull drive. How was Wichita? What did you discover in Wichita? What was the event there?
Well, there were multiple events. I spoke in two prisons, one called El Dorado. It has a supermax unit, which means super maximum confinement. I learned that there are some people who are locked up and literally they've thrown the key away. They never get out of a cell. That's because they're so violent that they can't be allowed to be actually near another person. And they're confined to a cell. Their bathroom, their toilet is in the cell. And there's a small cutaway in the wall where they probably have about an 8x10 area, sort of like a dog coop. That's their personal exercise area. And they stay that way for the rest of their life. And, talking with the chaplain Herbie, he said, you know, those men carry the image of God as well. Those men are part of my congregation. And you just begin to realize what a wonderful calling, but what a difficult calling it is to be a chaplain. He's a chaplain. I think they have an open position for a second chaplain, but for 1,300 inmates.
Oh, my goodness.
And another thing I learned is that every person who's convicted of a state felony in Kansas goes to this particular prison and is on lockdown for 6 weeks, the first 6 weeks they're there, while they sort out what kind of a prisoner is this and, where do they belong in the system? Where do they go from here? So can you imagine being convicted of DWI, for example, and your first experience in the Kansas system is you're in 6 weeks of total lockdown. You never leave your cell. There are just things that we don't think about. We were talking with Chaplain Herbie. He says, you know, I go into some cell blocks and the evil is so palpable you can cut it. The screaming and the hollering and the violence. And then he says, you know, at least once a week he tries to go to one cell block and goes cell to cell and just listens to the inmates, of what their concerns are, what he can pray for them for, what they're worried about for their family and their kids. And he said, you know, after I do 80 cells, I am absolutely drained.
I'll bet.
Which I can imagine. So I just don't think we think of our chaplains in prisons enough. I think they're probably almost forgotten the way they serve as well. And what I'm beginning to realize is not only when I go into a prison to talk about biblical context, the Lord willing, is that I get a chance to minister to the prisoners, but before and after, it's a chance just to be with the chaplain. And some of the things that we heard and learned, I'm sure the chaplain would say only to us, not to the warden, not to his supervisor. Maybe I suppose he would tell it to his wife. But there is a world out there that we just don't appreciate, and we really need the support. And I said to the people in Wichita, think about these chaplains, and if you ever want to do something to give them a brief sabbatical, put some money and send them to Israel for 2 weeks. It would be phenomenal continuing education as well as encouragement for them in their ministry. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, sort of observation number one. Observation number two is the inmates who come to the speaking venues that I'm privileged to be a part of in these prison settings are just wonderful guys. It's not till I'm in the car driving back to the hotel that I realize, oh, right, I've just been with prisoners. Never thought about that. They just seem such ordinary people. Some of them are extraordinary in the most positive sense of that word. Some of the questions I get are unbelievable in terms of their not only degree of difficulty, but insightfulness. And you realize that in many of these prisons, they have 5 and 6 hours a day of free time, and so that they are becoming Bible students. Mm-hmm. They know their Bible far better than the average church parishioner. And so it's really fun, and they're enthusiastic, and they're so appreciative when someone comes to be with them. And they're expressive. They have no illusions about who they are. No pretenses. They're open. They're transparent. It's really refreshing in a lot of ways. And I always say to churches, because I spend most of my time in churches, if you really want to revitalize your worship experience, adopt a prison and spend time at their worship experiences and getting to know them. It will really affect you.
That's a powerful idea. A lot of people are in a position to do that. I mean, there are prisons scattered all across the country that probably don't ever see people like you or presentations like you that would welcome the relationship. But I'm curious, now this may vary from state to state, but in Kansas, do you ever come into conflict between the state and religion? That do you have to fight that kind of fight to minister to in a Christianly way? Is there opposition to what you do?
There are layers to your question, and I will answer it beyond the state of Kansas. First and foremost, just about everything in a prison gets shaped by a warden. If the warden is a believer, a lot of doors can open. If a warden is not a believer, it's much more difficult to get in and to do the kind of thing that I do, you know, 2 and 3 hours a night for multiple nights, which is a big adjustment in the prison schedule. So that's kind of observation number one. There's a whole climate issue that varies from prison to prison. And then, thanks to Prison Fellowship, who's been operating in prisons for 30 years, however long, Chuck Colson, since he founded that ministry, there's some pretty good data that says that guys that go to Bible studies and go to church in prison have a phenomenally lower recidivism rate than inmates who don't. So there's this tension between the state, who knows that Christian things are good things in terms of outcomes of prisoners, and yet the struggle of how do you do these programs without being overtly evangelical, because for them that would cross the line between church and state. So you have a lot of middle ground things going on that are teaching Christian values and Christian principles, but maybe not using the same language as we're accustomed to in the church setting, which makes it more of a secular program, but with a values-based outcome. And implicitly, you know, most people know what's going on anyway. And so you have that tension, and the degree to which that tension is accepted or managed or fought against, again, is a function of the climate in that particular prison, by and large.
And of course, what I've seen of your presentations, and they've been wonderful, I would not call them evangelistic, although that might be a kind of a side effect of it. But it's really, really educational. It's presenting material that you might get in a college or university, just happens to be inspiring as well.
You can certainly put what I do in that category, and there are times I will say to the chaplain, is an altar call appropriate in this institution or is it not? Because some of the things that I teach, particularly on the passage side of life, can easily become evangelistically oriented in the way I develop and in the way I put the invitation and the call, you know, out to the audience as well. So I try to be sensitive to those kinds of things, but what I'm trying to do, and, you know, it can be under the historical umbrella, but boy, I am lifting up the real Jesus.
That you are.
In three dimensions.
The Jesus who said not to forget the prisoners.
Yeah, and, for everyone to see. And, you know, the biblical promises, if he is lifted up, he will draw people to himself.
Wichita, and then Dallas, and then down to Louisiana, huh?
Well, let's not get out of Wichita.
Oh, yet. Okay.
I was asked by one of our sponsors. There are four churches who come together to bring us into Wichita annually for 4 years. And one of the ladies on the sponsoring team asked me if I had some time on a certain afternoon free. She wanted me to meet a guy named Dr. Don Davis of TUMI, T-U-M-I. And that stands for the Urban Ministry Institute, T-U-M-I, which I had not heard of. And he had heard of Preserving Bible Times because of our trips to Israel. So we were able to spend an hour and a half together. And I talked a little bit about what Preserving Bible Times does, and he talked a little bit about what TUMI does. And here's the essence of what TUMI is dealing with. It started with urban ministries, inner city ministries. How do you equip inner city pastors to be effective teachers, preachers, pastors when they will never have a chance to go to seminary? And so they've sort of created the equivalent of a seminary equivalent that has courses and credits and that sort of thing that inner city pastors can take. And instead of spending maybe $1,000 a credit hour, if not more, to go to a typical seminary, they charge $10 a credit hour. And so it's economically feasible. And so they started 20, 25 years ago in that direction. Well, the issues that exist in urban ministries are the same as third world ministries around the world, and they soon found themselves teaching itinerant pastors in Africa and Indonesia and in India. And they've developed a whole curriculum and a whole methodology about how do you educate pastors who, some of whom can't really read and even write that well. And that's their calling. And so we got to talking about biblical context a little bit. And we were talking about frameworks, because I raised that particular issue about frameworks to see if they had rolled that into their methodology. And we had quite a fascinating discussion about their frameworks and some of the frameworks that Preserving Bible Times uses. But and that rapidly took up the better part of an hour. And in the time that I had left, I said to Don, can I mention one more thing here that we're doing at Preserving Bible Times that might be of interest to you? And so I immediately went into a first-person treatment of the calling of Levi. Mm-hmm. Probably did that for 10 minutes of the 30 minutes that I actually use it. And his eyes lit up, and his smile got wider and wider. And he said, "That's it. That's the last phase of equipping third world preachers. We have to equip them to retell the story. We have to equip them to become storytellers."
Now, just for listeners, this is the part of your presentation where you assume the identity of Levi and explain the worst decision in your life and the best decision in your life.
Yeah, and Barabbas, mm-hmm, and his situation.
It's kind of a theatrical presentation, yeah.
Yeah, and I could easily do that with Simon and a Great Catch of Fish or the leper, because here's the point. Once you see all of the contextual issues and you've repainted the picture and it's now in panoramic full color, you can now start to tell the story. And Don said, that's the last frontier. That's the thing that we need to figure out as the last step in equipping these itinerant pastors all around the world to bring the good news to people, is how can we best do this? And so we've agreed we're going to get back together by phone and maybe a future face-to-face visits here and start to work that notion through. How can we use context to equip pastors to better retell the narrative story.
You know, it's wonderful, but this is another serving on your plate, and another international effort. You've already got the children's and the orphans and the children's books going on, and of course your travels to Italy and to Israel, and now this, you're becoming a man of the world.
Well, I don't know about that, but I love to be a storyteller, mm-hmm. telling the real story, the full story in three dimensions, the way it was meant to be understood, because I'm convinced that's where the transformational power is going to be found. And, you know, it's going to take some real thinking through. How do you translate that all? How do you package that all? How do you then equip pastors in India who will never take a seminary class to become reasonably proficient? And I think, you know, that's got to really be thought through, because even in the Indian context, there'll be some who'll be gifted to do that. There will be some who have an adequate capacity to do that, and there'll be some who won't. Well, maybe they don't have to retell the story in the first person. Maybe they can retell the story in the second person. Mm-hmm. Or they can describe the story from a distant second-person perspective.
You know, a thought just crossed my mind here. There are Christian improv groups, and if Toomey can locate some of those and enlist their talents and their passion for this into teaching people how to do this, that might be a good starting point.
It sure will. So we're just on the front end of that, but I really found that to be the most exciting mm-hmm. portion of my trip, because it's another frontier. It's another new challenge to think through. And I guess it's my entrepreneurial nature, but I always love when those kind of things show up on mm-hmm. my doorstep.
Yes, yes, yes. And there were more miles in your future.
Well, we did. And we had we had 500 people come to a church in East Wichita for The Passion of Jesus, The Greatest Story Never Completely Told. Interesting church. It also does the Protestant version of the Stations of the Cross. And so they had a complete Golgotha set right in the front of the sanctuary for me to use when I did my Barabbas mm-hmm. story. The three crosses and the rugged rocks and all that. I mean, it was, talk about a perfect setting. It probably took up 20 by 30 feet in one corner of the front of the church. So it was great to actually be able to relive Barabbas and his journey to Golgotha, to see this person who took his place, Yeshua, mm-hmm. and then to be able to make that come up more alive by actually having three crosses and a rugged hill.
You right didn't happen to capture that on video and put it in the Preserving Bible Times library, did you?
Yeah, like a lot of things, it's over and done with before we even figure out what we should have probably done. But nevertheless, it was a great experience.
Okay. Well, did you went to Dallas? You went to Louisiana? Similar presentations, I would assume, in both locations.
I did three presentations in Dallas. I actually, at a church I've never spoken at before, spoke for 2 hours on Maundy Thursday, and they had never done that before. So I kind of compressed Passion Week into those 2 hours, and then they were kind enough to ask me to bring the Good Friday evening message as well. And so between the scourging of Jesus and Barabbas and the last words on the cross, that was our Good Friday reflection time. And from there, we went right into communion. And if you think back a couple of weeks, I think I developed this thought about in my Father's house are many mansions.
Yes.
And this fusing together of a somber celebration. Well, that's what we did. We had a communion experience that was a somber celebration.
Mm-hmm. Well, and for listeners who are interested in the content of what Doug has been teaching, most of that material we've covered in our conversations with him over the past 3, 4, 5 weeks, and they are available to you as podcasts on our website at brokenroadradio.com. If you go up to the archives or the podcasts tab, and then under Doug's name, you can find them listed there consecutively with brief introductions as to the topic of each. And I think you'll find them fascinating. And there's such incredible power in Passion Week that we miss from our Western Greek minds, our Western perspectives, that it would be a blessing to you, I think, to just to replay some of those podcasts. Doug, one of my, I don't want to call it a gripe, a pet peeve, but one of my observations about Scripture is that things seem to stop with the resurrection until you get into the book of Acts. It's like there's that 50-day gap there, and we're told very little about the risen Christ and his teaching. And I always think of it as kind of a graduate course for his disciples, but I'm dying to get more information. Now, there are some stories, some episodes in that post-resurrection period that I'm curious about. Well, for example, Jesus on the beach. When did the disciples go back to their occupation at that point? Did they not have a sense of a purpose as disciples, as apostles, to spread the word? What was their motivation to go back to Galilee?
Well, if you go way, way back into Luke 5, where we have the calling of the first disciples, and if you remember my development on how the young boys go to Bet Midrash school, the local synagogue school at age 5, and start memorizing the Old Testament, and most of that gets accomplished by the time they're 13, and then there's a cut, and only the best go forward for 2 more years, and then there's another cut, and then only the Rhodes Scholars go forward for a few more years, and then there's yet another cut before you're then encouraged to spend time with an itinerant rabbi. At each of the times that there's a cut, as you may recall, the local rabbi teachers will say to you, go back to the profession of your fathers, you know, whenever you don't make the cut. Mm-hmm. So that's what these guys have done. That's a part of their culture. They're familiar with that. That's what they were told to do when they didn't make the cut. Go back to the profession of your fathers. That's part of the fascination of the calling of the 12. By Jesus, these guys weren't good enough. They have sort of flunked out of the system. They weren't good enough to keep going on and on and on. And the observations we make there about how Jesus does extraordinary things with very, very ordinary people. So they've gone back to the profession of their fathers. I mean, that's the only thing they know. In this culture, you carry on the profession of your fathers. And while you may walk with a rabbi for 3 years, when that's done, you go back to the profession of your father. So there's nothing unusual about that at all. And we find Simon back fishing. But what's absolutely fascinating in John 21, verse 3, Simon Peter said to some of the other disciples, I'm going fishing. And they said to him, we will also come with you. And they went out and got into a boat. And that night, they caught nothing. Ring a bell?
Yeah, it does.
This is right back where it all started. They fished all night and caught nothing in Luke 4. And then they were called to be disciples. This is a remez for those of your listeners who remember that Semitic rabbinic teaching technique, R-E-M-E-Z, a deliberate hearkening back, that everyone knows and to something that everyone knows and understands, mm-hmm. for which no further explanation is needed.
I could see Peter standing up in the boat saying, this is where we came in.
Yes, and interesting in John's construct here, he's called Simon Peter, mm-hmm. not Simon or Peter. And you may recall from some of our earlier development work, the word Simon means pebble, and the word Peter means rock. And he is still in transition of going from pebble to rock. He certainly has blown a number of things along the way here. And his most recently, he's denied Christ 3 times. And so he still remains a work in process. And so the irony here is they've gone back to the profession of their fathers. They fished all night and caught nothing. It's deja vu. And there's Jesus on the beach, although they don't recognize him at the time, preparing a meal for them. And that is significant in this culture. To be willing to have a meal with someone means you accept them. You're willing to have the most intimate form of expression, a shared meal. We could even call this, and some people actually do, a meal covenant. And so there's Jesus, the one who was denied 3 times by Simon Peter, preparing a meal covenant to reconcile him, to forgive him, to restore him. It's really a lovely picture of the initiative of Jesus to, remember, rescue and restore. That is, he is known as the Lord's rescuer. His purpose is rescue and restoration. And we have this restoration scene here. And so when they caught nothing, they don't recognize Jesus on the beach. But the person on the beach, Jesus says, well, cast the net on the right side of the boat, the other side of it, and you will find a catch. And they did, and they were not able to haul it in. Now, does that remind you of anything?
It does. It does. Yep. That's
deja vu all over again. Right back to the way it started. Mm-hmm. You talk about bookending an experience here, if you're Simon Peter. And then that there is one difference here. Do you remember in Luke 5, when they caught the great catch of fish, what happened with the amount of fish in the nets? What did it cause the nets to do?
Well, the nets tore, yeah.
And down in verse 11 of chapter 21 of John, Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land, full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many...
Well, we got a hiccup in the audio here. Just a second. I think Doug will be right back. Well, we got Doug back here. It was really unfortunate that we dropped the call at that moment. But Doug, we're back, and Peter is hauling that net with 153 fish in it back to the shore.
And here's the one exception mm-hmm. to what started their ministry. This time, the net did not break. In verse 11, we're told the net was not torn. And then Jesus invites Simon Peter to have fish and bread with him. And then in verse 15... So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he said to them, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to them, tend my lambs. He said to him again a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to them, shepherd my sheep. And Jesus said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, tend my sheep. Couple of observations. Peter denied Jesus three times. He needs a threefold restoration. Hence this repetition in 15, 16, and 17. There's a triplicate here. That's a perfect match for the three denials that Simon has done. Secondly, I've always been struck by the fact, and I think that anyone in ministry would be struck by the fact, Jesus says, tend my lambs, shepherd my sheep, feed my sheep. He never said to count them. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's been in ministry knows the pressure there is to count.
Well, this is again discipleship versus evangelism, isn't it?
In many ways. And, you know, I have to live this out all the time. When I head off somewhere, I don't know whether it's going to be 500 people or whether it's going to be 50 people. Sometimes it's 22 people. And I just simply have to go by what Jesus says here. My job is to feed the sheep who come, not to lament those that don't. Hmm. And how many... moments for missions don't we have in churches where, you know, at some point in the recitation, we count the notches on the gun.
Mm-hmm. Is this worth doing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I really take great comfort and great solace here. Tend my sheep, feed my sheep, shepherd my sheep. The emphasis here is not on counting the sheep. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that pertains to what we do here at Broken Road Radio, the thought just occurs to me, because, you know, our listenership is still small, growing very slowly, but still small. And sometimes I go on the air and I'm thinking, you know, all this work, all this effort, and so few listeners. And then I'm always, always, always comforted by that thought, that even if there was one, this is well worth doing, what we're doing here.
Did I ever tell the story about Sam Wolgamuth in the story of one?
No, I've not heard that.
Sam Wolgamuth was president of Youth for Christ International, late 50s, early 60s. The dates are a little fuzzy here. And for whatever reason, he felt the Holy Spirit leading him to do a teenage crusade in Delhi, India. And so he eventually decided to do just that. He sent over an advanced team for 6 months. They worked on venues and partnership churches and counselors and all the infrastructure. And finally, the time came for the crusade week. And they did all of their Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday activities. And Friday was to be the grand finale. They were in a 5,200-seat venue in Delhi, India. It was packed with teenage Indian boys and girls. Sam himself gave the message, which he felt particularly inspired. And when he went into the altar call, not one seat budged. And so he went into a second altar call. Same outcome. Not one of those teenagers got out of their seats. Starting to feel very uneasy, he decided to do a third altar call and then say amen. And he was just in the process of saying, what have I done wrong? How did I misread this? What's going on? As he was completing the third altar call, one teenage skinny boy got up and came forward. And that was it. And Sam closed that crusade evening with a prayer and went backstage and felt like a total failure. After about 10 minutes, one of his staffers came to him and said, Sam, would you like to meet the young man who came forward tonight? And Sam said, sure. And the young man was brought to him. And Sam said, young man, what's your name? And that skinny 13-year-old teenage boy said, my name is Ravi Zacharias.
Ravi Zacharias. My goodness.
The power of one.
Talk about a seed and how it grows, huh?
Yeah.
And reproduces.
So, you know, it isn't the number. As much as we in our Western accounting-oriented way of thinking, return on investment like to think, it's the power. Oftentimes it can be the power of one. And as I go into prisons, sometimes, you know, I'll only get 25 prisoners, not 200. And I am reminded of this time and time again. It can often be in God's economy, you're there for one person.
Doug, thanks very much for the time this morning. For the grand tour, Wichita to Dallas to Louisiana, back home now to Columbia, Maryland. I want to mention that Preserving Bible Times has a terrific website. Wait a second. Did we lose Doug? We did too. Okay. Well, we'll say goodbye to Doug here off the air. But preservingbibletimes.org is a website you need to see. It's a gorgeous website. It's a tremendous resource for your church and your small groups and your Bible studies. I recommend it. You can link to them from our website at brokenroadradio.com. Preserving Bible Times just off to the right there on the homepage. So, again, our thanks to Doug for a great time this morning, and we'll talk to him again next Wednesday, okay? Music now from Bert Kempfert.